Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Friday, September 27th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Linda Feldman.
And I'm Noah Robertson.
First, some thoughts on the value of being present. Over the summer, Matt Dickinson and his wife, Allison, took many weekend trips to New Hampshire, home of the first primary, to see Democrats campaign for president. They saw Joe Biden, Beto O'Rourke, Amy Klobuchar, and several others. Like a good reporter, Professor Dickinson understands the benefit of being there and soaking it all in. And when you're a political scientist at Middlebury College in neighboring Vermont, it's almost a no-brainer. His goal was to listen. How are the candidates selling themselves? What are voters asking them? Impeachment just didn't come up, he told me. There was lots of policy discussion and candidate pitches around electability, but the ultimate sanction against an American president, to threaten expulsion via the constitutional process of impeachment in the House, and if successful, a trial in the Senate, was not top of mind. Now it is, following an explosive whistleblower complaint against President Donald Trump and Speaker Nancy Pelosi's announcement of support for an impeachment inquiry. All eyes are on public opinion. Which argument, for or against, will carry the day? Our lead story today explores sentiment around the country. Meanwhile, the Dickinsons plan to keep visiting New Hampshire and observing campaign events. Their next trip should be especially interesting. Now to our five stories. They look at the alternate worlds of opinion amid impeachment, the stakes in Afghanistan's presidential election, a civil debate over an old Moscow beer plant, how culture shapes our perception of music, and a Ugandan man's walk to fight deforestation. Our first story. With impeachment, the division between conservative media and the legacy news media promises to be so wide it is already as if viewers were living in alternate worlds. Is there a way to bridge that divide?
At the Mall of New Hampshire, Charlie sits on a bench. Asked about impeachment, he says he's against it because he voted for President Donald Trump in 2016. The Democrats will do anything. I hate to say it, but they don't have any morals, Charlie says. He watches mainly Fox News because he feels he gets a better picture of what's going on. Catherine Handy believes people who watch only Fox are the ones getting a limited picture. She had a family member who watched only Fox. She got them to branch out to NPR, PBS, and MSNBC, and now they regret their vote for Mr. Trump. Trump voters have the country's interests at heart, she says. The people who are pro-Trump are very patriotic. If they really knew what he was doing, they would be as enraged as the rest of us who are in the know, Ms. Handy says. Welcome to Impeachment Autumn 2019. As Washington struggles with high-stakes drama, the nation's citizens sometimes seem split into polarized camps that view the situation through different lenses. That division is shaped in part by party lines. But it is also due to the fact that those on opposite sides of the debate rarely consume the same news sources. This story was reported by Peter Greer, Krista Case Bryant, and Patrick Johnson in Manchester, New Hampshire, and Tybee Island, Georgia, for The Monitor.
The struggle for democracy doesn't end with the right to vote. To navigate Afghanistan's future as it confronts the Taliban, the president elected Saturday will also need to be seen as legitimate.
The stakes could hardly be higher in Afghanistan's presidential election Saturday. With the U.S. having suspended nearly a year of talks with the Taliban, responsibility for finding peace now falls more squarely on the Kabul government. Whoever wins Saturday will have to use the legitimacy they gain to preserve the Afghan state from further Taliban military advances. Threats to security are very much in play. The Taliban have vowed to disrupt the vote and have bombed election rallies. Face-to-face campaigning has been limited. Key candidates have been forced to convene virtual rallies, often addressing their supporters via video link. Already, the security clampdown has begun in Kabul and other urban centers, and from senior officials to mosque clerics, everyone except the Taliban have called for a large turnout. The Taliban will still say that it is not a legitimate government, that it is not a legitimate president, that only a few urban centers voted, and that it was fraudulent, says the head of a Kabul-based group that facilitates peace and rebuilding efforts. So we are all a bit skeptical about the result, and that's what scares me. This story was reported by Scott Peterson in both Kabul, Afghanistan, and in London for The Monitor.
While political speech is tightly controlled in Russia, there is increasing room for apolitical civil debate. That is what's happening around the development of the old Badayevsky beer plant site in Moscow.
Small business people, local residents, and newly elected opposition deputies of the Moscow City Council are uniting to stop a mega development project in a picturesque corner of central Moscow. It's the sort of apolitical, grassroots civic movement that may be familiar in the West, but is new, even seen with increasing frequency, in Russia today. Capital Group, one of Moscow's biggest developers, plans to build huge apartment blocks raised by 30-yard columns on the site of the former Badayevsky beer plant, a rare example of 19th-century industrial architecture. But despite the company's suggestion that the site is largely derelict, it currently houses more than 50 thriving small businesses. Some have spent millions of dollars restoring large sections of the old factory. They all received eviction notices ordering them to leave by October 15th without compensation. "We won't leave," says Oksana Skalatina, owner of the Mare Art Gallery at the site. "It's not just about all the money we have invested here," she adds. "We are struggling against arbitrary decisions made by big business and the authorities working hand in glove." This story was reported by Fred Weir in Moscow for The Monitor.
Nature and nurture is not an either-or proposition. When it comes to music, scientists are finding that acoustics, biology, and culture interact in complex ways.
If you play a middle C on a piano, and then play a high C two octaves above, it will probably feel like you're playing the same note. But is that true for everyone? A study published last week in Current Biology suggests that octave equivalents may be a product of Western culture. The results add a new layer of cultural influence to our understanding of how we perceive music. To study people whose ears have not been molded by Western music, researchers visited the Chimane, a remote indigenous tribe in Bolivia. There, they asked participants to listen to a simple tune and sing it back in their own vocal register. From a Western perspective, the Chimane would sing off-key, which sounded as right to them as octave equivalents do to Westerners. How we hear music, it seems, is as much a product of our cultural lens as our biology. "There's something very substantial about your experience and exposure," says Nori Jacobi, the study's lead author. "It's really transforming your mind in a way that you basically hear things in a different way." This story was reported by Owen O'Carroll for The Monitor.
Around the world, environmental activists are often targeted for speaking out. Where does the courage to keep going come from? For some, it's the idea that we don't really own this earth. We take care of it for the next generation.
Uganda has lost more than 60% of its forest cover in the last 30 years. Ask about why, and fingers often point to the little guy, a poor man with an axe clearing land for farming, or a refugee woman collecting firewood. But much of deforestation, environmental workers say, is thanks to a lucrative illegal logging trade. Speaking out can bring harassment, but William Amanzuru is undeterred. Mr. Amanzuru's network, Friends of Dzoka, is determined to protect the Dzoka forest, near the border with South Sudan. In March, he and a handful of companions spent 14 days walking to raise awareness, visiting schools, churches, and mosques along the way. Deforestation has scrambled weathered patterns here, where most people are farmers, struggling with rains that come too soon, too late, or not at all. It can be dangerous work, but Mr. Almanzuru's loved ones are his inspiration. When I look into the faces of my children, I ask myself, is this the world I will leave for them? He says. Friends of Zoka is all of us, says Stephen Drani, paramount chief of the main ethnic group in the Adjumani district, where the forest lies. We are just custodians. The environment belongs to the dead, and it belongs to the unborn. This story was reported by Liam Taylor in Adjumani, Uganda, for The Monitor.
Now, commentary on facing uncomfortable history from The Monitor's editorial board. In a unanimous ruling from Spain's Supreme Court on Tuesday, the remains of former dictator Francisco Franco will be exhumed from the monument known as the Valley of the Fallen. The timing of the ruling, 44 years after Franco's death, may seem odd, yet it could be a sign that Spain is finally confronting his legacy. Most Spaniards have resisted addressing the decades of fascist rule or dealing with those still affected by it. Any country with a checkered past has struggled over how to view its sins. Post-war Germany stands out as a model of repentance that earned forgiveness and turned the country toward peacemaking. The same should be true for Spain, a state with the second highest number of disappeared in the world. Moving Franco's body is no solution, but combined with recent attempts to recover historical memory, it's a start. Famous for forgetting, Spain is trying to remember. And with memory comes a sense of justice, even if delayed. With Spanish nationalism again on the rise, the best way to counter lingering resentments is honest reflection. Unearthing long-buried bitterness allows reconciliation. History can be healing. Spain now seems ready to review it. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thank you for joining us today. We hope you'll come back Monday when correspondent Doug Strzok looks at how editors and publishers are trying to save local news and maybe democracy. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective column explores the power of cherishing memories, even in grief. You can find it in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Riley Robinson, Morgan Anderson, and Jeff Turton.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2019.